Je vous présente le professeur Shaul Bassi de l'Université de Venise. Le professeur Bassi est un spécialiste de Shakespeare et je veux vous raconter une anecdote qui montre l'étendue de son imagination. Pour l'anniversaire du ghetto de Venise, il a imaginé faire un nouveau procès à Shylock. Et il a invité Ruth Bader Ginsburg, la célèbre juge américaine, hélas maintenant décédée, pour venir prendre la présidence de ce jugement. Et il va peut-être nous raconter un peu après ce qui s'est passé, mais vous voyez qu'il a une imagination débordante, une connaissance très profonde de Shakespeare. Malheureusement, il me dit qu'il ne parle pas français, il parle peu de français, donc il préfère de s'exprimer en anglais. Certaines d'entre vous m'ont demandé que ce soit en français, donc ce que je ferai, si vous voulez, c'est après que le professeur Bassi a répondu aux questions, je vais vous faire un tout court résumé de ce qu'il a dit pour ceux d'entre vous qui ne comprennent pas l'anglais. Mais bon, Shaul, tout d'abord, tu as rencontré Hamlet pour la première fois quand et qu'est-ce que ça t'a semblé ? Quelle est ta relation avec Hamlet ?
Alors, bonsoir. Merci beaucoup. Je suis honoré d'être ici. Parler d'Hamlet, c'est très difficile. Parler d'Hamlet après Albert Magal, c'est encore plus difficile. Alors, j'ai décidé, malheureusement, de parler en anglais. Je vais dire avec la reine Gertrude, « I pray you pardon me ». And it will be easier for me. Mais je vais dire une autre chose en français, que Shakespeare n'était pas allemand, il était italien. Non, c'est ça. Okay, I'm glad that you asked that question because I'm trying to think of where I think Hamlet is part of our imagination, and I can think of many important encounters with Hamlet. I'm sure probably I did encounter it in my Italian education, and certainly in bits and pieces. So I think that for many people, the experience of meeting Hamlet is that you don't get the whole thing, you don't get the 5 hours, you don't get the 2 hours, maybe you get only some chunks of it. And I remember a fantastic encounter with Hamlet, Peter Brook's Hamlet in the French version. And I think that the to be or not to be came very early so that, you know, it could be cleared out of the way. Because I think there's so much expectation that as early as the romantic period, the 19th century, the early 19th century, romantic critics were already saying that it's impossible to stage Hamlet, that, you know, that Hamlet has to be staged in one's mind and one's imagination.
Brièvement, vous voulez que je résume ou vous comprenez l'anglais? C'est pas la peine? Bon, d'accord. Alors, je ne résume pas. Merci. Ah, bon, d'accord. D'accord. Vous préférez que... Bon, le professeur Bassi a expliqué qu'il a rencontré Hamlet très jeune. Il a étudié en Italie, mais seulement en morceaux, que sa première rencontre était peut-être la mise en scène de Peter Brook ou le soliloque de To Be or Not To Be venait très tôt dans la pièce parce que depuis le romantisme, les critiques disaient il est impossible de monter la pièce parce que tout le monde attend de ces To Be or Not To Be.
Yes. I'm thinking of other encounters, one that has stayed with me for a long time and that I would like perhaps to comment upon later, is a Lithuanian production by the great Lithuanian director Eimontas Nekrosius, where Hamlet was a young Lithuanian pop singer that delivered the to be or not to be speech under a chandelier made of ice, and the ice would melt, which is an important metaphor in the play. And so this idea of melting has also influenced
me a lot. Too solid flesh.
Too solid flesh,
yes.
Yeah.
Il a raconté d'une production lituanienne qui l'a beaucoup marqué, où Hamlet était un chanteur pop qui chantait le « to be or not to be » sous un chandelier de glace, où le glace fondait sur lui.
And when you were so kind to invite me, I immediately thought of the wonderful quote, because Hamlet also exists in multiple quotes in various adaptations and novels and reference, some of, you know, full-fledged adaptation like Stoppard, but also important quotes like the one of Paul Valéry, L'Hamlet européen regarde des millions de spectres. And this is a sentence that has stayed with me for a long time and in the last few weeks has taken a new resonance for me.
Donc son point de départ va être la citation de Valéry qui est comment la citation Hamlet.
L'Hamlet européen regarde des millions de spectres.
Voilà.
Ça qu'il écrivait. He wrote it in 1919, of course, at the end of World War I, and so Hamlet as this sign of crisis that has been...
Qui rejoint peut-être la vision de Tarkovsky. Mm-hmm. Tu as choisi une citation pour ton intervention. Explique-nous un peu le sens de cette citation. Tu peux la dire parce que je ne l'ai pas par cœur.
The bold wind speechless. Bold wind speechless is one of the many images of nature in the play.
Les vents courageux sont sans parole.
Exactly. So the wonderful thing about Hamlet is that every time you read it, you are reading essentially a different text. And this never ceases to surprise me. I've taught Hamlet in the past, and I've reread it and very carefully this time, and it was as if there were many lines that took a completely different meaning for me.
À chaque fois qu'il lit Hamlet, il découvre un nouveau texte.
And in particular, I was really drawn to images of nature, images of the weather, clouds, air, vapors, the sea. And I would like to perhaps later talk a little bit about the different attitudes towards nature that Hamlet has vis-à-vis Ophélia.
Ce qui lui a attiré chez Hamlet, c'est sa relation avec la nature, le vocabulaire des choses de la nature, et il va parler de cela après.
But before that, I would like to talk about and to follow up on your wonderful fresco. And you said something about Hamlet being very popular with the Third Reich and with many other regimes, or to be a very topical play every time that there is a totalitarian regime. Yeah. And yeah.
Qu'à chaque fois qu'il y a un régime totalitaire, Hamlet devienne une pièce de grande relevance.
But it also, I think what is to me very profoundly disturbing is that in most cases, it is not censored, so that the totalitarian regime will allow Hamlet to be staged.
Oui, le régime totalitaire ne se cure de censurer la mise en scène de Hamlet parce que les lectures d'une mise en scène sont toujours nombreuses.
And one particular staging that I became aware of in the last few days is a staging of Hamlet. It was the first Ukrainian staging of Hamlet in Lviv in September 1943, the 21st of September 1943.
Donc en 1943, il y a eu une mise en scène de Hamlet en Ukraine.
Lviv had been occupied by the Soviet army in 1939, by the Nazi in 1942, and back by the Soviet in 1944. So what happens is that under the first Soviet occupation, theater was mostly, let's say, an ideologically communist theater. And theater was a business of the cosmopolitan Lviv with Jews and Poles and Ukrainians and Russians. When the Nazi took over, off went the Poles, off went the Jews. The Jews were killed, actually, or ghettoized. Ukrainian actors and directors were allowed to take over. And there was the first Ukrainian version of a director whose mother was Jewish, but that was something that was not fully in the sun, to quote the play. And Volodymyr Blavatsky, who was the head of the theater and played Hamlet, it is not clear whether it was a slip of the tongue or a deliberate choice, didn't say to be or not to be, but said, is it good or evil? And so you see how many...
Donc dans cette version en Ukraine, le to be ou non to be s'est transformé en... Est-ce une bonne chose ou une mauvaise chose? Est-ce le bien ou le mal?
So we know that there have been, you know, anti-authoritarian Hamlets. There have been Hamlets that stand for political resistance. But I think that thinking about Europe, it's so interesting, and one could say maybe Hamlet can mean so much that it's so malleable politically that it can really mean anything. And as you said, the Nazi allowed Hamlet to be on stage and Shakespeare to be on stage, mm-hmm. precisely because he could be hailed as a Germanic hero.
Mm-hmm. Oui. Cette ambiguïté permettait aux nazis, par exemple, de permettre que Hamlet soit mis en scène.
And if I can be the academic philologist for a second, there is one of the many interesting linguistic aspects of the play. There is a word that sounds Pollux, and we hear that, you know,
yes.
Hamlet's
yeah.
father is
yeah.
bearing the Pollux, yeah. and so Pollux could be the hacks,
yeah.
but
yeah.
the Nazi preferred the version where it really meant that he was killing Pollux.
Un exemple, c'est le mot Pollux. Le père de Hamlet attaque les Polaks, mais ça veut dire les Polonais ou ça peut dire une arme. Et donc les nazis ont préféré l'interprétation des Polonais.
No. So, I think that this political ambiguity, but also plasticity, I think it's very problematic and it's very interesting because you can really do a lot of things with Hamlet, and maybe later I'll try to do something myself that's a bit...
You mean now, or...?
Everywhere, I mean, anywhere. It's so interesting that so early on, Hamlet really came to mean something that is so cliché. And so I think it was Charles Lamb that says that you go around England and you see so many schoolboys saying to be or not to be, and that really becomes like a patchwork.
Que Hamlet est devenu un cliché donc depuis longtemps, et donc il a envie de faire quelque chose avec Hamlet. Mm-hmm.
Another quote that I would like to share is a very simple one, but again, it's interesting and it's funny also to pick details, and something that I had never done is to look at all the European locations that are mentioned in the play.
La géographie européenne qui apparaît dans la pièce.
Yeah. So the queen, the mother, says, and this is actually a site that you've already mentioned yourself, is, you know, I pray thee stay with us, do not go, go not to Wittenberg. Yeah, so so one could argue that Hamlet is the first Erasmus play, because the geography of the play has both, at the very beginning, Europe as the space of war, and so the borders that are attacked, violated, negotiated, and so we have that, that it's so topical today, but it's also the space of great intellectual traffic. Laertes comes here to Paris, you know, and his father is very suspicious of what might happen in Paris. Hamlet has studied in Wittenberg. That, of course, was not only the university of the place where Martin Luther started the Reformation, but also the place where a great European philosopher, Giordano Bruno, had been. So there is also this interest of possible influence of his Giordano Bruno influence on Hamlet and Shakespeare, something that had been noted since the 19th century. But just for fun,
Je résume la scène de Hamlet et l'Europe tout entière. D'un côté, l'Europe en guerre, et de l'autre côté, l'Europe intellectuelle avec ses universités que Hamlet, Laertes fréquentent. Mm-hmm.
So, just for fun, I'm going to read the name of the places that are directly or indirectly referenced in the
Les noms qui sont cités, géographiques qui sont cités dans Hamlet.
Yeah. Norway, Rome, France, Wittenberg, the Rhine, because the Rhenish wine. Of course, plenty of reference to Greek mythology. Troy, England, Vienna, Italy, Turkish, Syracuse, Provence, Poland, Switzerland, Normandy. So if... When I think of Hamlet, when I thought of Hamlet, I thought of a very claustrophobic play. You think of the castle, you think of this, you know, peripheral country. But then, in fact, it describes a very vast geography that connects so many different places, east, west, and also Mediterranean. And so I think that's so interesting that in terms of the mythological references, Hamlet is also a Mediterranean play.
Hamlet est une pièce méditerranéenne si on prend en compte les références aux zones de la Méditerranée qui sont citées dans la pièce. But also, peut-être, cette géographie est une indication que si bien le monde est étendu, l'Europe a toutes ses parties, Hamlet continue à penser qu'il est dans la coquille de la noix, in that nutshell, and count himself king of infinite space.
King of infinite space.
Et c'est l'Europe du commerce, comme je disais. Mm-hmm. Maintenant, l'Angleterre s'étend et ses voies commerciales touchent à toutes ces régions de l'Europe.
Since you mentioned that wonderful image, there is this incredible novel by Ian McEwan that,
ah, yes,
you know, imagines Hamlet being in the womb of
fait référence à un merveilleux petit roman de Ian McEwan. À mon avis, c'est un avis personnel, il est le meilleur romancier de langue anglaise qui écrit aujourd'hui. Il y a un petit roman, je ne sais pas sous quel titre il a été traduit en français, qui raconte la vie de Hamlet avant de naître, dans cette coquille de noix qui est le ventre de sa mère.
If I can go back to the ideas of images of nature, Hamlet is famously a play with a lot of puns, a lot of punning, a lot of wordplay, which of course poses a big challenge to the translators. And there is this famous line where Hamlet says that, you know, he's too much in the sun, where he plays with the word sun, like, you know, the sun like the star and the sun in the family. And so the little exercise I've done is to see whether we can read the natural metaphors in the play literally. So do the opposite of what most of the characters do.
Il y a beaucoup d'images de la nature dans la pièce. Shakespeare aime beaucoup les calembours, les jeux de mots. Donc, par exemple, il dit « je suis trop au soleil », mais en fait, ça peut être entendu comme « je suis trop dans le rôle du fils », « son and son ». Et le professeur Bassi se propose de nous parler d'une lecture littérale de ces métaphores, donc non comme les personnages les interprètent, comme images des émotions, mais vraiment comme images de la nature à laquelle on peut se référer.
You and I have met this very important writer and thinker, Amitav Ghosh, from India, who's written this, I would say, groundbreaking book called The Great Derangement, where he says that the climate change, the climate crisis, is a crisis of culture and the crisis of the imagination. And I think that this is a very important point that needs to be taken into account. And so what happens if we read Hamlet as a symptom or as a sign of the crisis of the imagination?
Le professeur Bassi dit que Amitav Ghosh, qu'il considère un grand écrivain, a écrit dans un de ses romans que la crise climatique que nous subissons est une crise culturelle, une crise de l'imagination, et que peut-être on peut regarder ou lire la pièce Hamlet avec ces yeux-là.
So we are literally too much in the sun. So the planet is becoming too hot. Okay, so this is a very literal-minded reading of a pun. But some very important critics have said that there is a cultural problem that I think it's encapsulated, epitomized by Hamlet, that in the English tradition, but certainly in other traditions as well, images of nature have been used almost entirely as metaphors. And Hamlet is the perfect example because Hamlet is the play of the mind, is the play of introspection. And so most of the images of nature are used as images of introspection, metaphorically. So if we reverse the process, let's see what happens.
La littérature anglaise emploie ces images de la nature comme une réflexion des images des émotions. Voyons si nous pouvons regarder ces images comme des images de nature.
The sea of troubles, right? To be or not to be, you know. The sea of troubles, if we took all the reference to the sea, verify that they are all used as images of the inner state of mind of the characters.
La mer comme une image du monde intérieur.
And I was watching this wonderful film made on Hamlet by the great Russian, but Ukrainian and Jewish director Grigory Kozintsev, that shows Hamlet in front of a sea with the waves breaking onto the shore. So it's the film that makes it visual, the presence, the physical presence of the sea. So, you know, the other reference I want to make is that Alberto Mangel has written a beautiful piece on Gertrude, where Hamlet is suspected of spending too much time on his meditations and torments, and says, well, and this is a problem of the weather we have here in Denmark. I think you say something like, you know, it's 6 months bedtime or something like that.
L'image de la mer, prendre des armes contre une mer de soucis. Et il fait référence à un film d'un directeur, metteur en scène, russe-ukrainien qui montre Hamlet face à la mer avec les vagues qui battent. Mm-hmm.
And maybe later I'll say something about the chicken, but that's for, you know, as well. So going back up to this idea, it's an interesting coincidence that one important political moment in our relationship to the climate crisis was the conference in Copenhagen, so in Denmark, of all places, in 2009, where it, you know, the conference of countries agreed that climate change is the number one problem, certainly one of the most important political problems today.
Une conférence en 2009 à Copenhague sur les changements climatiques.
Yeah, yeah. And so the two categories that I would like to offer here, one comes from an academic called Stephen Estock, and that's called ecophobia, you know, the fear of nature. So this is a very important feature of our culture in general, and we can find it in Hamlet. Hamlet is the perfect ecophobe.
Le terme écophobie se présente chez Hamlet, mais dans notre monde aujourd'hui. Mm-hmm.
Why is Hamlet an ecophobe? Hamlet has this idea that man is a quintessence of dust. And he talks a lot about dust, he talks a lot about earth, he talks a lot about clay. He has a very strong sense of the materiality of men, but what he sees is mostly decline, decay, rank, everything smells really bad.
Il voit dans l'être humain qui est poussière la destruction, la rouille, une chose qui se débride.
Yeah. So, Hamlet's pessimism is, you know, he seems to be a very tragic character because he doesn't see any form of regeneration. He basically, you know, famously says to Ophelia, get thee to a nunnery. You know, mm-hmm. He sees also sexuality and reproduction or something inherently bad, mm-hmm. as it were, especially thinking about his mother and Gertrude.
Il voit le fait de la vie comme quelque chose de négatif et il dit à Ophélie qu'elle aille dans un couvent justement pour ne pas avoir de fils.
So it is not Hamlet that says something is rotten in the state of Denmark, but this idea of rot is really one of the
la pourriture.
Principal tropes of the play. And when he reads the nature, he reads nature, as I said, metaphorically. He looks at the clouds, and he also makes fun of Polonius, saying, you see that cloud? That cloud looks like a whale, looks like a camel. And it's interesting because on the one hand, he offers us an idea of a vision of reading nature as a realm where you can also shift from one domain to another, the domain of meteorology to the animal kingdom.
Il voit dans la nature quelque chose qu'on peut lire. Il regarde les nuages pour se moquer de Polonius, lui disant ça ressemble une baleine, ça ressemble un
un chameau.
Un chameau.
Who is the opposite of Hamlet? And that's Ophelia. So you have ecophobia and you have ecophilia, that, you know, it's also a little Hamletic pun, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think we need to recuperate strongly the ecophilia of Ophelia's. How does Ophelia think about nature? She doesn't perhaps think about nature as much as she acts with nature. And she is identified with nature in multiple ways.
Et Ophélie est le contraire de Hamlet parce qu'elle aime la nature et elle ne réfléchit pas à la nature, mais elle agit avec la nature.
She speaks with flowers, famously. She gives flowers, she gives herbs, she gives rosemary, she gives rue, she would like to give violets. And in one of the most famous scenes in Shakespeare that actually do not happen on stage in Shakespeare, her image as the floating corpse is strongly identified with the floral world.
Il parle dans un langage des fleurs et l'image, une des images les plus fortes, c'est l'image de Ophélie noyée qui on ne voit pas sur scène mais qui hante la scène.
Her clothes spread wide and mermaid-like. We see the dead Ophelia floating on the water through the words of Gertrude. So it's the queen, it's a woman, it's the words of a woman that report the image. So it's for once is the woman that controls the representation of the woman in a play where both Ophelia and Gertrude are, as you also mentioned, trapped in the roles of women.
C'est la reine qui décrit Ophélie morte, et c'est donc une des rares instances dans la pièce où les femmes prennent le pouvoir de la parole.
I live in Venice, and we used to have a mayor who is a very distinguished philosopher who wrote a very thought-provoking book on Hamlet, where he used Nietzsche to read Hamlet. And where he said that the problem of Hamlet is that he cannot properly decide because the decision to act would be his father's decision. And so he's facing this dilemma. And so unable to do what Nietzsche would have called a transvaluation of values, he just acts randomly. He performs a random act of killings, as we know. And so the only, let's say, I'm simplifying here, the only good character in the play is Ophelia, because she is silent. And silence is the only way to get out of the symbolic order of society, which is this cycle of killings and of you know, power struggles.
Le professeur Bassi vit à Venise, et un ancien maire de Venise écrit un livre sur Hamlet en se basant sur Nietzsche, et que dans ce livre, Ophélie est la seule qui, par le biais du silence, arrive à s'en sortir de cette mêlée d'assassinats et des crimes.
But of course, as I just said, Ophelia is not silent. Ophelia speaks. Ophelia is often represented as a naive young woman, but she is not naive at all. For instance, she makes good puns about how sexually licentious are members of the clergy. So she's and she's not just the object of the sexual desire. She's very aware of sexual desire, but she. Again, I want to reiterate this fact. Both she and Gertrude are always manipulated by the males of the family.
Les femmes dans la pièce sont manipulées par les hommes dans la pièce, et Ophélie n'est pas silencieuse. Elle parle et elle est intelligente. Elle fait des calembours sur la vie du clergé et sa vie sexuelle. Mm-hmm.
But again, I think that the fact that she uses a different language, a different code, that of flowers, with their multiplicity of meanings, not only the symbolic meanings, but also the, really what these herbs do. And today, we are really learning that flowers and plants have their own language. And this is something that, to some extent, the play draws our attention to.
Et Ophélie utilise le langage des fleurs, et aujourd'hui nous savons que les fleurs, les plantes, le monde végétal a son langage.
But the other aspect to me is this reference made by the queen to Ophelia as a mermaid, as a hybrid creature. So we know that Shakespeare was infatuated with Ovid and the Metamorphoses, one of his favorite books. When you think about identity, we see how identity in its, I would say, worst possible expression is a kind of defending, guarding the boundaries, telling that I am who I am because I'm not you and I'm ready to kill you. What the great Franco-Lebanese writer Amin Malouf has called, les identités meurtrières.
Le problème de l'identité que Malouf définit comme une identité meurtrière dit « je vais te tuer parce que tu n'es pas moi », tandis que Gertrude définit Ophélie comme une sirène, et c'est une image qui vient de Ovid, un auteur préféré de Shakespeare.
So Hamlet inherits a notion of identity that comes with an armor. The ghost appeared with an armor. You know, so the idea of you have to, in a way, accept the legacy of yourself as a warrior, as someone that is defending and guarding the individual and the national boundaries and the borders.
Et Hamlet, par contre, se définit par l'armure de son père, donc comme quelqu'un qui défend sa propre identité et celle de son royaume.
He may not be comfortable with that, but that's the kind of legacy that he has inherited, and this is why also he has to struggle with it. This idea of hybridity, I think, is incredibly topical, and the siren is not only a reference, of course, to mythology, is a reference to the Odyssey, is a reference to this idea of opening up our individual, corporeal, national boundaries to other identities, including that of animals. So I've talked a little bit about flowers. Now I would like to say a few things about animals.
L'image de la sirène permet d'ouvrir la notion d'identité et incorporer celle du monde animal.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about some animals. So Hamlet is full of reference to animals. We've talked about the whales, the camels. There are, of course, the mousetrap, the
weasel.
Weasel, it's the zoology of Shakespeare is incredible. The zoology of Hamlet is even more incredible. If I could reference the great rival of Hamlet as the greatest Shakespearean tragedy, King Lear famously describes his daughter as centaurs, and Gloucester describes as tigers. And so this idea of hybrid creatures as monsters.
Lear, la pièce qui fait panion avec Hamlet, dans Lear, les filles du roi sont décrites comme des centaures ou des tigres, incorporant cette identité monstrueuse au personnage.
Shakespeare's age is obsessed with the idea of monstrosity. The monster is what is always, you know, falling outside of the norm, outside of the normal. Again, this image of Ophelia as a mermaid, as a creature that, in a way, finds in water a form of life that is very different from the idea of the male, especially male, but also her own corpse that Hamlet goes back to over and over again. So death by water is in a way something that also promises or alludes to regeneration, to recreation, to rebirth, whereas Hamlet is obsessed with the idea of the rotting flesh, of Polonius being eaten by the worms, another important animal that is mentioned.
L'âge de Shakespeare est obsédé par les monstres et de façons différentes. Dans le cas d'Ophélie, parce qu'on la compare à une sirène, l'eau est un symbole de la renaissance, tandis que pour Hamlet, l'idée de la mort est la poussière, ce qui ne se régénère pas.
And in fact, at the end, it's very important for the play to see Ophelia transformed in a cadaver, literally, you know, the flesh for the worms, because it has to be reinscribed in the same social order. So she has to be returned to that idea of the rotting corpse rather than this borderline creature that exists in water and that has fascinated artists and filmmakers for many, many centuries now.
Tandis que pour la cohérence de la pièce, cette renaissance de, aquatique de Ophélie, à la fin de la pièce, elle devient un cadavre qui est enterré, qui devient la nourriture pour les vers.
And this is perhaps the moment where I should say that, of course, this is a good example of reading into the play. This is not something that Shakespeare, you know, well, he had it in mind because he wrote it, but I think it when I was invited to discuss Hamlet, I was thrilled. I was also overwhelmed because everybody has written about Hamlet. I said, all right, you know what? Instead of rereading all the great thinkers, all the great scholars, of course, I've read many, but I said, all right, let's see, you know, let's just take the play and read what is in the air, as it were, into the play. And this is something that I would, if it makes sense, invite everybody to do. So to read it without that heavy sense of the ghost. Let's not use Hamlet as the ghost that comes to you and say, remember me. No, so let's in a way forget the previous, or tries to forget the previous Hamlets and try to create our own Hamlet.
N'agissons comme des lecteurs qui travaillent sous l'empreinte du fantôme qui dit lisez de cette façon-là, mais soyons libres de lire sans tous les commentaires célèbres de la pièce. L'interprétation que le professeur Bassi fait n'est peut-être pas dans la tête de Shakespeare, mais elle est dans les mots, donc c'est permis.
When I teach Shakespeare, I always use a midrash, a Jewish parable, where Moses comes back to Earth and goes into a yeshiva where they're studying, and he sits down and doesn't understand anything at all. And at the end, he hears someone says, "That's the law of Moses." Yeah. And so I think that Shakespeare would do the same. If Shakespeare could enter a classroom or a theater today, he might not really even realize that they are doing Hamlet, but this is exactly the great thing about Hamlet.
Quand le professeur Bassi enseigne Shakespeare, il utilise une midrash, une parabole juive, qui raconte que Moïse retourne à la terre et va dans une école rabbinique et il entend les gens parler et il ne comprend rien. Et après la leçon, il dit « c'est la loi de Moïse ». Et que Shakespeare aurait ressenti la même chose s'il venait voir une représentation de Shakespeare aujourd'hui.
Mm-hmm. If I could make one final crazy interpretation.
Une dernière interprétation folle.
Folle, in the spirit of Hamlet. It is a well-known fact that in representing Hamlet, there's always a conflation between most famous speech, to be or not to be, and the most famous prop, stage property, the skull of Hamlet. Yeah, so the skull of Hamlet, so we see a lot of images, could be serious images, serious illustrations, films, where you see Hamlet with the skull saying to be or not to be, which of course are two separate, fully separate scenes. I can't remember the name now, but there was a Russian person who was so, because of course Shakespeare was German, Italian, and Russian as well, because this is Shakespeare is really the European author, who died and decided to leave his own skull to the Royal Shakespeare Company, hoping that he could play Yorick, you know, on it.
C'est les deux images de textes qui sont les plus symboliques de la pièce sont « To be et to be » et le crâne de Yorick et qui sont mis ensemble dans des images. Évidemment, Hamlet ne dit pas « To be ou not to be » en regardant le crâne. Et il raconte d'un Russe qui a légué son crâne à une compagnie shakespearienne pour qu'on l'utilise sur scène pour qu'il soit présente dans Hamlet.
Ironically, the law in England prohibited the use of a real skull on stage, so they made a perfect replica of the skull so that they could, okay, you know,
la,
have
la
it both
loi
ways.
Anglaise ne permettait pas l'usage d'une une vraie crâne.
But this also made me think of this great idea of recycling, which I think it's a very important part of
on va parler de recyclage.
Yeah, recyclage. So I said, and I stand by my idea, that an idea proposed by more authoritative scholars, that Hamlet is the ecophobic character and Ophelia is the ecophilic character. So the one who really hates nature, and she's the one who in a way is at peace with nature, or has a more harmonious comedic relationship with nature. But there's one passage to me where I think that Hamlet, in his profound ecophobia, says something that is incredibly inspiring. I don't know if... And that's, again, in the gravedigger scene, where, after seeing Yorick, he makes this famous meditation about, in a way, the democracy of death. That after death, we are not, we're all the same. We all turn to dust and clay.
Donc, pour revenir, Hamlet écophobique, Ophélie écophilique. Et dans la scène du Fossoyeur, Hamlet parle de ceci.
So the four lines are: Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away. Oh, that earth which kept the world in awe should patch a wall to expel the water's flow. So he imagines that Caesar, the great, and of course we have to remember that he was talking about these great emperors and kings in front of real kings, and so, as you know.
And having produced Julius Caesar.
And having produced
that's it. Mentioned in the play.
Absolutely.
Polonius play,
yeah, yeah.
Julius Caesar.
Those are the same years, 1599, is incredibly productive. The very last years of Queen Elizabeth. So, of course, this one could see this as the apotheosis of Hamlet idea, morbid idea, of the materiality of man. It's a very typical sort of, you know, even...
On peut considérer cette réflexion sur la démocratie de la mort, tout le monde meurt, César, comme une
so,
réflexion...
Yeah. So that the standard memento mori, voilà. And we're all going to become skulls and cadavers, everything we see in the, you know, Baroque culture. But there is this incredible... thing which is also kind of heretical, that the body is not preserved, is not kept there, maybe in view of the resurrection of the bodies at the end of the days, but the body back to its materiality, to its being made of earth, is actually used to keep the wind away, to protect us from the extreme weather condition.
Donc le corps recyclé pour faire un mur pour nous protéger du vent.
And also to patch a wall to expel the water's flow. And, you know, as someone who is from a city that is constantly threatened by water flowing, the idea that, I mean, this is a paradox, this again... could be seen as a kind of nihilistic point of view, but there is something bizarre where we think, all right, can we think of ourselves as recycling our corporeality in order to protect us from the changing weather conditions?
Recycler nos corps pour nous protéger du changement climatique. It might be a good idea to suggest that all Venetian politicians should donate their body to construct a dam.
It might not be good for that either, but that's so these are just, let's say, you know, glimpses of possible interpretations of the play. Perhaps the great pleasure is also to be reading that with actors that have a completely different approach, but the melting chandelier is also a way that, you know, we can really recycle Hamlet or upcycle Hamlet in multiple ways, and that's, I think, what Europe needs. So Europe needs texts that are shared, of course, which is the amazing, I think, you know, concept of this wonderful cycle of lecture. It needs something that we can all recognize. So the reputation of Hamlet is such that we need some text that we can all somehow relate to, but they need to be constantly upcycled, as it were.
Il est important que l'Europe ait des textes qu'on puisse partager entre tous, mais des textes qui soient recyclables, donc qui soient interprétés à chaque fois d'une façon nouvelle. Thank you very much.